LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Available September 13th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
The last link in the chain of production is the retailer. On his knowledge of cutting rests much of the success of the meat business. Good cutting enhances the quality of good meat. In his way, the meat cutter is an artist. Poor cutting results in an inferior piece of meat, regardless of quality.
That's a clip from a 1950s video that features a butcher explaining how to break down a hind quarter of beef.
While choice cuts of meat are more publicized, the secondary cuts are just as nutritious, and in the hands of a good cook, any beef is capable of producing gastronomic miracles.
Back then, the average annual consumption of meat was 57 pounds per person, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now we eat, wait for it, roughly 200 pounds of meat a year. It's at an all-time high.
The butcher shop, I really thought to myself, there's something missing in Los Angeles, and that's the availability of incredible meat.
That's Chef Curtis Stone. He owns a restaurant called Maud in Beverly Hills. And he just opened this new spot, Gwen, in Hollywood. It's a high-end restaurant with a patio, a grill, two bars, and a butcher shop.
You know, in America, of course, we're more used to buying our meat and protein from the grocery store, the supermarket. But at home in Australia, we still have old-fashioned butcher shops, and that's all they do. And there's a real craft there, and unfortunately, it's a craft that is on its way out. There's not a lot of butcher shops here in Southern California anyway, and yeah, it's interesting to try and bring it back.
Half a dozen butchers are behind the counter. They break down heritage hogs, make octopus terrines, and walk customers through the particulars of grass-fed Wagyu beef from Australia.
I am just butchering a whole side of pork.
Alex Germasek is one of the head butchers here.
So what we have here is the top half. It's your Boston butt, the rib loin, and the center cut loin. And so we're taking the butts off. The butt is actually the shoulder. Believe it or not. I'm taking those off, and then we're cutting out the center muscle, the eye muscle, it's called the copa, and we're making what's called copa seca, which literally means dry copa, and that's one of the cured items that we will have in the restaurant. It takes roughly 8 to 12 weeks to dry fully.
Curtis Stone is part of a small but vocal group of chefs trying to bring the artisanal meat or seafood market back. Michael Cimarusti of Providence Restaurant opened Cape Seafood and Provisions. They buy seafood from a community-supported agriculture program called Dock to Dish. Since April, Cape Seafood has been selling fresh and smoked fish at its West Hollywood store. There's The Cannibal, which is a butcher shop, restaurant, and bar that opened in Culver City in July. And Chef April Bloomfield plans to open a whole animal butcher shop in New York later this month.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a counter-revolution against commodity meats.
Patrick Martin's founded Slow Food USA. He's also the president of Heritage Foods USA, which buys livestock from farms and then sells the cuts online.
These butcher shops and retail outlet component to restaurants are kind of at the forefront of this movement to be able to trace the meat that we eat. The commodity world had basically pushed the envelope too far. They had confined the animals. They were reliant on a system of antibiotics to keep the animals alive during their short lives. And more being talked about is the fact that they were genetically manipulating through selective breeding. So, you know, with all those things happening at once, there was a desire for a better supply, and I think these guys are taking advantage of that.
At Belcampo Meat Company in LA's Grand Central Market, a dozen people are lined up in front of the counter to order velvet and cowboy steaks. At the bar, diners order organic grass-fed burgers and humanely raised fried chicken. Then there are the people watching butcher Alyssa Christensen using a sharp handsaw to split a 50-pound lamb carcass in half.
This is more of an old-fashioned way of breaking down an animal. A lot of places use bandsaws. We just have a handsaw here, cleavers.
Anya Fernald is the founder of Belcampo.
It was obvious to me you could buy great produce in California, and that had been really figured out. But meat was a hard thing. You know, the best way for me to get the quality that I wanted was to buy direct from farmers, which was logistically very complicated. And of course, there are some producers at the farmers market, but you know, it was like buying a frozen, bloody bag.
So in 2011, Fernald began building an organic farm and slaughterhouse on land in Mount Shasta, California. Now she sells meat from animals raised and processed on the farm at butcher shops and restaurants in Northern California and Los Angeles.
And I also sense, obviously, that there's a lot of money in meat. You know, people are willing to spend for quality.
Retail reports from the USDA show that consumers increasingly are willing to pay more for their legs of lamb, ham hocks, and steaks, especially if they come from animals that are well-treated and raised nearby. Often a local bone-in ribeye or a pound of bacon can cost more than double its conventionally raised counterpart. Across town at the Cannibal, Dylan Carrasco is cutting a huge purple and white ribeye with a bandsaw.
So what do you use that bandsaw for?
Bone-in ribeye. So basically what we do is we get them in. It's called a 103 section. It's just the size of the ribs that they leave on. When we get them ready for the restaurant, we cut the ribs off, and usually we smoke these for about 6 or 7 hours and then grill them off as a skewer sets or for a dish in the restaurant.
That's one of the reasons the butcher shop restaurant model is appealing to Gwen and the Cannibal. What doesn't sell at the butcher shop can be worked into the restaurant menu. The butcher counter's pretty quiet today, but on the restaurant side, diners are sipping frosty pints and eating root beer, cornbread, sausage, and cured country ham. Here's the owner of the Cannibal, Christian Papanicolaou.
Like anything else, your customers tell you what they want very quickly, and they said, we love it here and we want to eat here. And it became something that, as much of a butcher shop, it's, you know, it's a restaurant as well, where people are coming and eating pate and drinking beer and sort of, you know, enjoying themselves in both capacities, maybe taking stuff to go as well.
Michael Cimarusti is doing much the same thing at his shop, Cape Seafood and Provisions. And of course, the skill of chefs and recipe inventories add value to preparations sold at all these shops.
We have a vendor up in Washington State who we buy wild-caught salmon from. This salmon happens to be from the Columbia River. It's dip-net caught by Native Americans, where they, you know, they set up platforms over the Columbia River, and then they dip-net these fish right out of the water as they're swimming by. It's a very sustainable method of harvest.
So Cimarusti buys that fish in bulk at a good price and has it delivered to his restaurant, Providence.
And then we're able to transfer that fish over to Cape Seafood and Connie and Ted. So it'll be on the menu tonight in all three places. And, you know, obviously at Cape Seafood, it'll be there in the case to be purchased fresh. We'll also smoke it. So it'll be available in many different forms smoked. And that fish, I think we're selling it for like $24 a pound or something. For wild-caught, sustainable, beautiful salmon from the Pacific Northwest, that's very affordable.
So then we literally just split this guy right down the middle.
Back at Gwen, it's not Washington State salmon that Curtis Stone is hoping to introduce to LA diners. It's rabbit.
Yeah, it's funny because in Australia, we grew up with rabbits. You know, it's actually, there's a bit of a saying, thank you, mother, for the rabbits, when you see an old friend, because, you know, if you lived in a rural part of Australia, there are rabbits everywhere. Of course, they brought them over from England when they settled the country, and come to the States, you sort of think, huh, where's the rabbit?
Stone says that he and the other butchers at Gwen will share recipes and cooking tips with anyone who's interested.
It's something I love. I mean, I know I'm not going to create a revolution and turn Los Angeles into the rabbit-eating capital of the world, but I want to supply it for those that are interested in it.
Even with the handful of artisanal butcher shops popping up in Los Angeles, the jury's still out as to whether Gwen, Providence, and the Cannibal's diners will also choose to shop where they're eating. We'll be continuing to follow the story in the days and weeks ahead. You can hear the full conversations that I had with all the chefs and restaurateurs featured in that last piece on our website. Just go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And while you're there, learn more about cuts of meat you might not know so much about, like the Denver, the Velvet, and the Bavette. We're going to take a break from meat in a second, but first, check out this 1999 radio spot. You might recognize actor Sam Elliott's voice from The Big Lebowski. After Robert Mitchum died, Elliott became the voice for the American Beef Council. Let's roll the tape.
Beef stroganoff, beef bourguignon, Irish beef stew, beef brisket, Chateaubriand, sauerbraten, roast beef, Catalonian beef ragu, Mongolian beef, chicken fried steak, steak Diane, grilled steaks balsamico, hamburgers, sizzling beef, spicy braised beef, barbecued beef ribs, beef Wellington, pepper beef, beef jerky, beef with broccoli, beef burritos, beef fajitas, beef tacos. Do you see where I'm going with this? Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Next, we're going to take a breather from meat and visit what we think might be the only vegan butcher shop in the U.S. It's located in a place you might least expect it, our nation's heartland. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Vegan butchery. That's an oxymoron, I know, but in Minneapolis, siblings Kale and Aubrey Walsh are all about it. They're selling meatless ribs, beer brats, Cuban pork, and even chicken at a shop they opened last year called The Herbivorous Butcher. Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I understand that you were raised in Guam and that you ate meat. So who went vegetarian first?
I went first. Kale and I are pretty far away in age. I'm 12 and a half years older than him, so he was 6 months old when we moved to the United States and about 1.5 when I went vegan when I was 14.
So, Kale, was she a huge influence on you when it came to eating?
You know, not much could get me away from Little Tokyo for a bit. But, yeah, after a while, the peer pressure started to build. And 5 years ago now, it finally came to a head before I started college and needed a fresh start. And I saw that she was full of energy all the time and very vibrant as a person. So I had to make the switch. It was an easy sell.
You were willing to walk away from pork.
Oh, yeah. I never much liked pork, but oh, my. I did eat some steak in my day.
Are you both also vegan in addition to being vegetarian?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
Describe the experience of walking up to your, quote, meat case. It must be pretty interesting for people.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's just like walking into an old-fashioned butcher shop that you'd see in, So I Married an Axe Murder, something like that. But, yeah, you would never know looking at our case that our products are vegan. You know, you see steaks, you see chops, you see chicken, sausages, you know, juicy ribs, the whole line.
Deli meats, yeah. And, you know, in fact, we've had customers walk in and ask for a specific cut of beef. And we sort of giggle and point them in the way of something that might be the same shape.
You don't reveal?
If asked, we reveal.
It's low key.
But it's in the name. Vegan butcher. Plant-based butcher.
So do you make everything in-house?
We sure do.
Absolutely. Yep.
It just seems like what you have done is the most sort of complete exploration of this kind of eating I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
It mostly, as Kale always says, comes from hunger, which couldn't be more true. We just get hungry for certain things and or foods we ate when we were younger, and we just make them.
Yeah, we keep building on that. So we got, you know, a rotating selection of probably
70 products.
Yeah, at least now. 70 to 80 products.
So those 70 or 80 products, are each one made from the ground up separately, or do you rely on a few different bases?
Most of them are ground up. We do have a few bases, like our deli meats, you know, sort of rely on the same ratios. So our different product lines, you know, use different ratios to mimic the texture. So our sausages will have different ratios than, say, our steak. But, yeah, they're all pretty much ground up.
Let's talk about the steak, just to give us an idea of what we're talking about. What is the primary ingredient or the base?
Most of our meats are a wheat base made with a high-protein wheat flour. And the steak utilizes, you know, various vinegars, apple juice, tomato juice, you know, molasses, a whole bevy of different things to, you know, create that irony flavor you'd get in a steak. And, you know, we even have the fat in the ribeyes now. So you grill it up and it'll sizzle just like a steak would. Mm-hmm. It'll drip out of the hot coals if you're grilling it.
Yep, it browns. It just gets juicy just like a steak would.
Is this as much art project as it is food business?
Maybe more like a Play-Doh as kids project.
Yeah, it seems very crafty.
Yeah,
it seems very crafty because, I mean, the fact that you added on the fat, I mean, it's really interesting what you're doing. You're sort of creating faux items.
Oh, yeah. You know, we've got, you know, the opportunity to marble in fat to look just the way we want it to. You know, it's sort of like Bob Ross's palette. You know, we've got all these ingredients that we can combine to make various colors. You know, the chicken is white like chicken would be. The steaks you cut open, they're red, you know, unless you cook them all the way through. So, yeah, we have fun.
Yeah, it's everything is shaped by hand. So I guess each butcher is an artist, making it look like its animal counterpart.
Yeah.
So the ribs, describe the ribs to me and how they're made.
Sure. So the ribs have the same base, the same high-protein wheat flour base, but they get a lot of love. The cream ribs are our most popular product. They have been for a while. And, yeah, those utilize sesame oil, you know, a lot of soy sauce, ginger, to create sort of a Korean-style sauce. Then we throw them on a hot grill top and sear them to get that, you know, sort of seared, charred bite that you get in a regular rib. Then we baste them in our Korean sauce, cover them in sesame seeds, and they come out looking so beautiful. Oh.
Is there anything that you have in the shop that people who are gluten-free can enjoy?
Yeah, we do have a couple products. Our entire line of vegan cheeses, we have both almond and soy-based cheeses. We're working on some cashew cheeses right now, but all of those are gluten-free. We also do a pulled pork that we use jackfruit, and that's also a gluten-free product.
That's so interesting. Jackfruit seems to be having its close-up right now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally. And it's delicious. It takes on flavors really well. One of our butchers has come up with a pulled chicken, and it's delicious. It tastes like grilled chicken that you just shredded.
Let's go back to the cheese. Your camembert has been described as richer than Bill Gates. So once again, do you create all of these cheeses in-house?
We do also in agonizingly small batches. It hurts. I'll be at the kitchen till 3, 4 in the morning. You know, people have been ordering so many of them, but
it's like 24 pieces at a time. It is the smallest batch you can possibly imagine.
When you threw open the doors, were you immediately embraced by the community or was there a lot of confusion?
No, I would say we were definitely immediately embraced by the community. Grand opening day, we had a line that was, you know, 2.5 hours long, and that goes for the next day. And I think it's something that people have thought about and wanted, but weren't sure exactly how to do. It's kind of like people have just been thinking about this, and we finally gave them something that they could bite off of.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine the kind of commitment it's taken to create that number of products. Have you run into any brick walls when you've been developing products, something you just couldn't quite get right yet?
Yes, we both have our Everests.
Yep.
For me, it's Spam. I grew up eating Spam. Guam is the number two consumer of Spam in the world. So I grew up eating it, and I've been trying and trying and trying, and I just can't get it.
You really need to get that because nobody should be eating Spam.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, and my personal Everest is a salmon. That was my probably biggest failure. Just came out of the oven looking like a swamp monster. It was so sad. But I'm going to get it someday. I'm going to get it a good smoked salmon that flakes just like salmon would.
I do think we might have a new Everest, though, because we had a chef from Los Angeles call today, and he's interested in shrimp. So.
And most of the shrimp on the market's fake anyway. So
herbivorous seafood. Here we come.
I love it. I mean, talking about being an artist, I can just see you painting the lines on.
Oh, totally.
Oh, no, please, no.
Do you wholesale some of your products?
Yeah, we definitely do. We've started to wholesale quite a bit in the Twin Cities and now all over the United States, from Los Angeles to Arizona, New York, Philadelphia. We're kind of getting everywhere now, and it's really, really exciting.
Are you considering opening shops in other cities?
Yeah.
Yes, we absolutely are. We're in search of spaces out west right now. I won't say exactly where, but we will be out west within the next year.
Yeah, I would say if you opened here, there would be a line.
Yeah, we actually, in June, took more than half of our butchers and took a trip out to Portland and to Los Angeles for the Vegan Beer and Food Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And we were definitely greeted with open arms at both festivals.
Oh, I'm sure. Do you have online sales if people who are listening want to buy your products?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You can go to our website. It's just www.theherbivorousbutcher.com. And we have several different packs that you can order to make different meals. We have a vegan starter kit. We have a summer grill pack. And coming up at the end of the month, we'll be releasing our pizza pack.
Are you going to be sculpting turkeys?
100%. Oh, we were just talking about
it. Ready to do.
Yep, stuffed turkeys this Thanksgiving and hams this holiday season.
Well, thank you so much. What an interesting idea and a really, I mean, I've never eaten them, but just looking at it, what a fantastic execution.
Thank you.
I've been talking to brother-sister duo Kale and Aubrey Walsh. Together, they operate the country's first vegan butcher shop in Minneapolis. Get more information about the Herbivorous Butcher, including what their vegan cuts look like, on our website. If you've ever shopped at a fresh market stall in Italy and seen the prepped minestrone veggies or a beautifully trimmed artichoke ready to take home, then you understand the meaning of the words vegetable butcher. In fact, it's not surprising that Eataly, the famed Italian food hall, would have such a butcher to help shoppers with their produce. Cara Mangini was one of the first. Her aim is to put produce at the center of the American plate. Her book is The Vegetable Butcher, because really, before you can eat your veggies, you must first know how to slice and dice them. Hi, Cara.
Hi there.
Since Los Angeles is getting its own Eataly next year, why don't we start there? Can you describe what the vegetable butcher counter was like and what your responsibilities were?
Yes, it's an amazing opportunity, essentially, for customers to walk up to the vegetable butcher with all of your produce for purchase, and the vegetable butcher will slice it and dice it and prime it so that you can get a step closer to cooking when you get home. And what I found in that experience, actually, was that people could actually, you know, bring you your vegetables and keep shopping while the vegetable butcher would prepare it. But so many people would stick around and watch the process of breaking down produce. And what I learned in that experience was that even the most sophisticated New Yorkers were, you know, sort of stumped when it came to working with vegetables, and were surprised and amazed by some of the really simple tips and tricks and techniques that I was showing them.
Was there a particular vegetable that people had the most difficulty with, or a particular technique that you were asked to do for them over and over again?
Well, artichokes definitely, I think, were the most intimidating for people. And watching just how some simple techniques would help break them down faster was certainly very helpful. And I got tons of questions about that, and I did tons of demos on artichokes. Celery root was one that's just a gnarly looking root. And people were always amazed that not only could you eat that root, but that just some really simple preparations, maybe pairing it with a really wonderful olive oil and Parmesan lemon, that it's delicious. And you can eat it raw. And then, of course, in terms of just the service aspect of the vegetable butcher, tons of people would bring their winter squashes, so butternut squashes and other squashes. I find that to be one that's just challenging and time-consuming for people.
Yeah, people tend to always think that you have to start with it whole. when it's really easier to just start with it in pieces.
Absolutely, I know. You sort of need to break it down into pieces that are much easier to handle. And of course, to find a flat surface, you know, cut a flat surface so that you have a sturdy side to work on and the squash won't fall out from under you or slip on your board.
Yeah. When I do that little thing, when I teach classes, people are like, what? And I'm like, well, you don't want it to roll away from you, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's so important when you break things down. Sometimes it's just somebody saying it and showing it, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think it makes vegetables much more approachable and a lot less intimidating for people.
I also think that it's really honest, this idea of vegetable butchery, because it seems like butchering meat gets all this attention. And actually, vegetables are just as complex and just as different one from another. So to sort of just address the issue of that there are techniques that it's good to learn, I think is a good place to start for people.
Absolutely. You know, I think if we want to put vegetables, it's my mission to put vegetables in the center of our plates. And if we want as a whole to eat more vegetables and to enjoy vegetables and celebrate the seasons, we have to know how to approach them, how to pick up any vegetable and know how to break it down. And I think if we don't intuitively know how to do that and just feel more comfortable and confident with these ingredients, that we're never going to get excited to cook with them. And it's always going to feel like a bit of a chore.
What I would love is if we could start with when we take them home. Do you recommend that people put them away as they are straight from the store? Or is there a certain amount of wash and prep that we should do before we put everything away?
First, I recommend really purchase your produce in its prime, and you're going to get that extra shelf life out of it. So you want to get things when they're in season and then as fresh as possible. And then when you get it home, it's best really to store it immediately and not wash immediately. Certain vegetables do require a little bit of prep before you prepare it, and those mostly are roots. So things like beets or carrots that have tops attached, any vegetable that would have their greens attached, you want to cut those because they'll draw moisture from the root, and that's when you end up getting both dry and soft vegetables. So you want to trim greens and separate them. And of course, you don't want to throw those away. That's a second vegetable in one.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those tops. What do you like to do with beet tops?
You know, you can use it like kale or other greens. So I love to just saute it with garlic and lemon. That's just a really simple way to use them. There's a wonderful recipe in my book for a grain-based dish with beets, and you steam the beet greens. But, you know, you can use it in a pesto. You could do a beet greens pesto or, you know, throw it into a salsa verde. Yeah, I think people are getting more and more comfortable with kale and maybe Swiss chard. And so if you think about it in those terms, you can use them in very much the same way.
Yeah, they're very similar to Swiss chard. And now let's talk about carrot tops, because for years, everybody just threw them away without thinking about it, unless you had a rabbit in the house. And now we're being told, no, we can use the tops.
Yes. I think what's wonderful for people to consider is that carrots, when the greens are attached, are a wonderful sign of freshness. So it's a good indicator that you maybe don't have to peel your carrots. They're probably going to be full of moisture at that point, and you don't need to take that extra step. And then, of course, separate the greens from the roots. And then for the greens, again, I like doing a pesto with it, or you can do also a salsa verde in the same way. Or we use them to garnish dishes. So it's like if you're used to throwing them away, you're really stretching the money that you spend on vegetables. You can, you know, find these other uses for them.
So we're so lucky out here in Southern California. We have incredible farmers markets, and we get some vegetables that are kind of unusual that you actually talk about in the book. So let's talk about crones, which, you know, a lot of people see them at the Santa Monica market when they're in season. And despite the pitch of the farmer, they're reluctant often to take them home. Can you describe crones and how you use them?
Yes. Well, first, it's wonderful that you have access to them. And I do think they're a little bit intimidating, but they're quite easy to work with. They're known also as a Japanese or a Chinese artichoke. I think they have sort of a similar flavor to a globe artichoke and a sunchoke, but they're not related. But they have this wonderful nutty flavor, and they're quite juicy. And I think they're very similar to a water chestnut in that sense, that they have this sort of crunch and a juiciness to them. I think they're wonderful in stir fries, but they have just this wonderful texture and juiciness and flavor. So I really recommend working with them. You have to blanch them briefly, and then you can sort of clean them by salting them, shaking them in a towel, and then you sort of release a little bit of the skin and the dirt. And there's step-by-steps of that in my book. So I think that piece is maybe a little bit intimidating for people. But once you get to know how to clean them, they're really quite easy to use. They don't really require any work from you.
Yeah, they're kind of gnarly. So yes. They
to start, yeah.
Yeah. And what about cardoons?
Cardoons. So cardoons are wonderful as well. I have to say, in research for the book, they were one that gave me a little bit of trouble. I come from an Italian family, and my grandmother always talked about cardoons as something that they would dip and have on New Year's Eve in the bagna calda in the oil and anchovy mixture. And so I'd always known about it, but I never really had an opportunity to try them. They're rare to find, certainly outside of California. And they are really a wonderful vegetable, and they're in the artichoke family. I think they deliver a lot of that artichoke flavor with less work involved. So I think they're wonderful to do a pesto, or you can stuff a ravioli with the pesto. They're wonderful breaded and fried, but they're really a wonderful vegetable to work with if you have an opportunity. It does require a bit of a lesson in terms of how to break them down. But really, once you get the hang of it, they are quite simple to work with. But they do feel intimidating from the start.
It's like having a plant that's just a huge, big artichoke stem.
Yes.
From a flavor standpoint.
Yes, exactly. And then in terms of the look, they look like the biggest stalks of celery you've ever seen. And they require a little bit of, you need to strip the leaves. And some of them might have some prickly edges that you have to pull, trim. But they really do deliver all that wonderful artichoke flavor that you would find in the stem and in the heart of the artichoke.
Let's move on to some big vegetables that are more familiar to us, like cauliflower and eggplant, which both have this great round shape, which lends them the ability to be cut into a steak, which is a nice substitute, instead of having meat in the middle of the plate. They're both really, just really satisfying. How do you like to prepare them?
With eggplant in particular, I think eggplant sometimes gets a bad rap for being bitter. The key to that issue is really buying it when it's really fresh and in season. More mature eggplant tends to be more bitter. So I think first with eggplant, we have to just get over that idea that it's going to be super bitter. And when you cook it, it can become quite sweet and nutty. I think that eggplant lends itself really well to cooking it on the grill or roasting it and getting a little bit of color on it and getting some of that smoky flavor. Really simply, you can cut an eggplant in half and score it and tuck in some garlic slices into those slits and then grill it or roast it. Pair it with a grain and maybe a garlic yogurt or some kind of salsa or sauce. Really, that's just really simple cooking, but also really, like you said, satisfying and hearty cooking.
Do you salt them first?
I don't. I think that ultimately that's one of those things that sort of gets in the way of getting eggplant on the table. It feels like a hurdle to work with it. And so I like to just really simplify it. If I buy eggplant when it's really fresh and use it as soon as possible, then I'm not worried about salting it and, dealing with any kind of a bitterness issue. So I think it's best just to not salt, because usually that means you're more likely to cook with it if you eliminate that step.
Now, what about cauliflower?
Oh, there's, so many wonderful things to do. But in terms of really putting it at the center of the plate and maybe using that thicker a steak-like cut. You know, you can cut from top to the bottom of the crown, cut the cauliflower into slices, nice thick slabs, and then just brush it with olive oil and sprinkle it with salt and cracked pepper, and then roast it. You just put it on a sheet tray and roast it. I think it pairs really well with roasted potatoes and maybe a steamed or sauteed greens. And then in the book, I have a wonderful recipe for a red pepper romesco sauce that I think works really well with it. But that's, you know, even if you don't do all the other pairings, you can very simply brush it with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and just roast it.
We kind of are obsessed a bit with pie here. And especially this time of year, we have pie in the brain. And with every vegetable to work with, it's interesting that you chose to showcase celery root in your pot pie recipe.
Yes. You know, I think that I just love celery root, number one. I think it's, you know, an underappreciated vegetable. It does look like it's a bit of work to get to that wonderful flavor on the inside, but it actually isn't. You know, once you get to know its curves and the parts to cut, it's quite easy to prepare. And it's wonderful because you can serve it raw or you can cook with it. And I think it just has this wonderful earthiness to it. And in the pot pie, it pairs really well with sweet potatoes and apples. And I think it just makes a really hearty, super flavorful, extremely satisfying pot pie for these, you know, fall and winter months ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Kara. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
Kara Mangini is chef and founder of Little Eater. Her book is The Vegetable Butcher, How to Select, Prep, Slice, Dice, and Masterfully Cook Vegetables from Artichokes to Zucchini. In a minute, we find out how the sausage gets made. Not really sausage. At the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Stay close.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
They've absolutely perfected the pork chop. I mean, you will not find a better chop, I don't think, in any restaurant. It's over a wood fire, and it's out of this world.
That's Oliver Woolley of Peds and Barnett talking about the pork chop at Hatchet Hall in Culver City. Laura Avery caught up with him at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with Chef Brian Dunsmore. Here's Brian.
The older I get, the less I want done to my food, especially when you're working with such a great product such as, you know, Peds and Barnett pork. So we get like the big boy chops, and then we just do a heavy brine on them. And then our buddy Matt Parker from Shiitake Happens, we get B-grade chanterelle mushrooms from him, which are like the ones with blemishes that aren't like as appealing to the eye. Kind of like people would buy like the secondhand fruit.
Visually distressed.
Exactly. Yeah. To make jam and stuff, sure, like that. And we just basically air dry those. We dehydrate those to the point where they get like a little bit crispy. And then we buzz them into a powder. And then we just brush the pork chop with like a little bit of smoked lard. And then we pat it down with a dehydrated chanterelle mushroom crust with some thyme and a little bit of black pepper. And then we grill it over the almond wood to a nice medium minus. Now that's okay to do.
When you say brined, so you're soaking this in liquid with spices?
Yeah, we do a really simple, heavily salted, heavily sugared brine, and we cure the pork chops for 24 hours. Like, no exceptions. If they're not cured for 24 hours or brined for 24 hours, we don't serve them. They won't be on the menu.
What happens to that wonderful, you talk about those fat boy pork chops, they have that wonderful fat ring, or, you know, the edge. What happens to the fat during all that brining?
Well, we start them, we get the bone in. So we actually start the grilling standing up on its end to kind of heat the bone through. And then we drop it over on each side, and then we roll it onto the fat side to kind of render a little bit of that. But we do not trim any of the fat off. So after we grill it with the chanterelle crust and the thyme, we let it rest for a while, and then we slice it up on the plate, and then we, quote unquote, we sauce it with a smoked Mangalisa lard that we get from Oliver. So we get the lard, and then we basically just reinforce that with Broadbent's country ham scraps. So we just kind of bring that up and kind of let that steep for a little while. We hit it with a little bit more of the mushroom powder, and then we go over with the smoked lard. Serve it with a little bit of grilled lemon, and that's it. It's not changing. I can eat this thing every day.
How thick is this pork chop?
I would say it's about 1.5 to 2 inches thick. It's a fat boy. It's good.
So is that your specification for 1.5 inches thick, or you saw it that way and you wanted to try to cook it? Because a lot of pork chops are much thinner.
Yeah, in the South, we call those minute chops, mm-hmm. like the ones that you get at like Waffle House and whatnot. But we were claiming pretty much all of his pork chops, even like the ones near the smaller end. But we decided, you know, we'll just take only the big boys. And when they're gone, they're gone. And we're just selling them faster than he can grow the pigs. So.
And how did you find Pete's and Barnett?
We found them through the farmer's market. I remember when we first heard about them, everybody was just freaking out. But they're like, oh, my gosh, have you tried this ham from Pete's and Barnett? I was like, what the hell is Pete's and Barnett? And then I met Oliver, and now we're good friends. And he's probably in at the restaurant once a week. It's like I tell him to go somewhere else. He's like, no, I'm cool.
How does the flavor differ on Pete's and Barnett pork from regular pork?
I think what the most special thing about the flavor and the texture of the pork. So the Mangalisa crossbreed, you know, they're a Hungarian pig that was originally bred for lard until, you know, America got super health conscious. And then, you know, they were like, oh, we can't eat pork fat. And then they kind of dwindled off. But it's that fat that makes it just super creamy. The texture of the fat is what really makes it special. That's why we choose not to trim any of it off. And then it also has like a super sweet meat. I've never had any other pork like it. It's definitely the best pork I've ever had.
Brian, are you originally from the South? And is this where you kind of have developed your appreciation for rich food?
Yeah, I guess so. I think, you know, coming from the South, you have such a strong food culture and food heritage that just goes back so far, especially with pork. You know, like back in the day when everybody settled in America, it's like we had to survive. And I think that's where everybody's like, oh, why do Southerners cook with so much bacon and so much cured pork? It's like because it didn't go bad and they didn't have anything else to eat. But, you know, after living in California for as long as I've lived, I'm just as Californian as I am Southern. So it's definitely lightened my hand.
Brian, thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
It's great talking to you, too. Thanks, as always.
That was Brian Dunsmore. He is chef owner of Hatchet Hall down on Washington Boulevard in Culver City. And just loving this wonderful heritage pork we have here at the farmer's market. I'm talking now with Oliver Woolley, who is the farmer who brings us the wonderful pork that Brian was just talking about, Pede's and Barnett's. Mm-hmm. And Oliver, you and your brother Justin and your family, you were well known for years growing those wonderful South African protea flowers. Yep. And we turn around and now you've got pork. So tell us a little bit about how the pork came to be such a big part of your business.
Oddly enough, it actually was the beginning of our business. But in England, like in the late 50s, we started, I wasn't born yet, but my grandpa founded a company there. And the name of the farm that it was originally on was Pede's and Barnett's. It was a medieval farm. I think the boundaries had been intact since the 1500s, and it's still there now. So he started raising pigs there, and he was doing the Berkshire or Berkshire breed, as pronounced it here. So that was kind of our start. It's a black pig. It's what's famous in Japan. They call it Kurabuta. It's the same thing. Super good. Very fatty, like creamy, beautiful fat. And the meat's much darker. It's richly marbled. It's just a lot more flavorful than what most people are used to.
How did you get the pigs over here from England?
I mean, originally...
Don't stay on a boat.
No, it came over here in various forms. Some not completely legal. Even semen coming in shampoo bottles on airplanes. That was not me. That was my grandpa. He did whatever it took, basically, to move things around. But, I mean, the thing is, now it's a lot easier. You quarantine the animals for a certain amount of time, and then you introduce them into your herd and grow it from there.
And you have you've got the protea farm, where is the pork being raised?
It's about 10 minutes away from the flower farm. We can actually see the edge of that farm from the hills that our protea grow on. Mm-hmm.
This is in San Diego County?
Yep, North San Diego, Valley Center.
Yeah. All right, and the pigs probably have a wonderful life. They're probably eating fantastic food. Is that one of the things that you that makes them taste so good?
That's a huge part of it, yeah. And we, I think because we've had a lot of years of experience in it, you come to understand how important the diet is. This is something that I think takes a lot of new people in livestock a long time to understand, is that they need a balanced diet. You can't feed them, when avocados are in season, a truckload of avocados and expect the end result to be consistent. You know, it's going to be all over the place. So we feed them a balanced diet, no corn, no soy, none of that nonsense, no antibiotics. And then they live under oak trees on that property. And so they, like in the fall, say like October to December, they had a ton of acorns. I mean, literally like enormous amounts of acorns. And they end up digging massive holes wherever the acorns were because they think they'll be like 10 feet down in the ground. But it's they eat very well and they have a lot of space to run. They get a lot of exercise as opposed to a lot of pigs that stay kind of stationary and they don't have any room to move. Ours are the opposite. And a lot of people think that, you know, why is it so tender if they get so much exercise? It almost seems like it shouldn't be, but it, you know, I think it puts more marbling in the meat because the muscles get worked, and it seems to be really beneficial.
Acorns must have a lot to do with it too, just in particular.
Definitely, yeah. Especially if you buy our pork in the late fall and winter, it's crazy. It's very heady, like really deep, deep flavor, even more so than it is the rest of the year when it's still good.
And how long are they raised before they are harvested?
It depends on the pig. Some grow a little faster than others. Some are greedier than others. But typically like 10 months to 12 months.
And how much do they weigh at that time?
We slaughter at like 225 to 250, 250 pounds. So the hanging weight on a carcass, we shoot for around 190, 200 pounds.
Okay, and where do you get them slaughtered?
In Fresno, typically. We have to take them all the way to Fresno.
Why?
It's the closest place. There's a few closer plants in LA, but they're for massive, like, industrial scale production, and they'll take 1,000 head at a time. But if you want to take like 10 or 15, there isn't any other option for USDA.
Oh, so that's a how many hour truck ride for those pigs?
It's about 8 hours from our farm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And then all this wonderful cuts, the cuts that Brian was talking about, the big boy pork chops and all this. Do you have all your cuts custom done at a specialty shop?
Yeah, we have a USDA butcher we work with, and we're really particular with them. I think to begin with, it was hard because they were used to doing it sort of the normal American way, which is just to cut it up with a bandsaw and you end up with just a few cuts off of a pig. Like, and we're really interested in other cuts from other countries. So we do a lot of Japanese style butchery, a lot of French and Spanish style as well. So you get three or four times as many different individual cuts off of a pig as you would the normal way.
What are some of those cuts?
So we cut a lot of collar or copa, which is an Italian, and also a Japanese cut, which is cut from the best part of the pork butt. We do secreto, a Spanish cut. We do pork skirt steak. We do a cut called toro, which is from the inside of the cheek. A lot of pretty interesting, strange, but fun cuts.
So you're using pretty much the whole animal?
Absolutely every single thing, from nose to tail. We sell all of it.
Yep.
Snouts?
Oh, yeah. All of it.
Feet.
It's amazing. When we first started, we had a really hard time selling that. But now it's like, honestly, the more difficult cuts are much more flavorful, and people are finally realizing that.
Your breeding program, do you have sows and then...
Sows and boars,
And boars. You have both?
Yes, we do. And we have three different lines, genetic lines, all pure English Berkshire. And so we keep a very tight herd. We're very tight with the biosecurity. We do some farm visits, but not much. Nobody that grows pigs elsewhere is allowed on our farm. And it's for the disease control. Pigs are very susceptible to that. So to be able to do the breeding effectively and properly, you have to be careful with that. But yeah, we do the breeding. Our pigs, if they're healthy, they get 8 to 10 pigs per litter, which is typical. Mm-hmm. So, and the sows have about 2 litters per year.
How many pigs do you have right now on your farm?
On the ground, right now about 160, 170. So we're not a big operation.
Are you going to have enough pork to supply your customers?
I will make sure of that.
All right, because this is going to be a run-on pork. I get the feeling that there's going to be a lot of people wanting this pork pretty soon.
With us.
All right. Okay, Oliver, well, thanks so much. We're glad you're here. You're at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica Market, Sunday Hollywood Farmers Market. Thanks so much, Oliver. It's
a huge pleasure.
That was Oliver Woolley. He is the owner of Peds and Barnett's and Sugarbush Protea Farm. And he is raising this wonderful Berkshire heritage pork that we can now enjoy right here in California. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In case you haven't noticed, this show has been all about the butcher shop. But what about all the mom and pops that have been serving LA for years?
All right, this is Peter Bloomberg for Good Food. I'm here at LA Fresh Poultry. What is your name?
Abdul El-Hawari.
And what is the most popular item you sell here?
Usually chicken, number one. And then comes after that, turkey, quail, ducks, squab, rabbit.
And what kind of chicken do you sell the most of?
The most of it we sold the Rhode Island Red, you know, which is the colored chicken, you know. After that, it comes the white chicken, like the one they sell it in the supermarket. It's just this, like this one, just scale, fresh, you know, and more tasty, more healthy, you know.
And how long have you been open?
I've been in this business since 1984, and this location since 2006.
And what's your favorite thing to buy here?
My favorite to eat or to buy?
Well, both.
Unfortunately, a lot of people, they don't know the importance of the squab.
So your favorite thing to eat is the squab?
That's for myself. The squab is just, it's the young pigeon. And this is very good for when you eat it, you know, a lot of vitamin and a lot of energy, you know. For the customer, you know, usually the chicken and then the turkey when the holiday comes. And after that comes the ducks and the rabbit. The rabbit is very nice because there is very low cholesterol on the rabbit, especially in this weather, you know. I recommend people to eat the rabbits. There is no fat. And more healthy, you know.
And can you say the name of your business just one time?
As LA Fresh Poultry.
We close out the show with a weekly restaurant recommendation from Jonathan Gold. Don't go anywhere.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day and find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Remember The Cannibal, that restaurant that just opened in July that has a butcher shop attached to it?
There is no getting around it. You have like a giant pig skull in the middle of your table.
Well, it turns out that's where our favorite food critic is eating this week.
And you are actually like tearing the lips off and leaving the grinning teeth behind. If you flip it over, apparently there's half a tongue inside, but we didn't get that far.
A lot of people, when they hear the name Cannibal, they think, oh, okay, meat. It's going to be a heavily meat-based restaurant. Does it live up to that misunderstanding of the name?
Well, it's a butcher shop with a restaurant attached to it. The restaurant is named after the nickname for the great Belgian cyclist Eddy Merckx.
Yeah, they're real bike heads, those guys.
They sponsor a bike team. They have theoretically a bicycle valet.
I love that.
The beer selection, I don't know why beer to me signals like a new kind of restaurant, but it kind of does. The wine list is pretty good. It has a lot of interesting sort of organic and natural wines, but the beer list is enormous.
And it makes a statement, I think, when a place opens with, what, a 500-bottle list?
Yeah. I mean, they have at least 400 or 500 bottles on the list. And there are things that aren't on the list that sort of may mysteriously make their way to you if you befriend the beer sommelier in the right way. Beer sommelier?
It's not a sommelier.
I think they call themselves Cicerone.
I love that. Like they're taking you on a journey.
Yeah, I always think of Cicerones as basically the grandmother that sticks around on the first and second day to make sure that you're not going to do anything untoward.
Well, that's good. That's good to have somebody like that guiding your beer palate.
Sure. You can think of them as the beer Virgils. They're very big on aging things. You can get a whole pig or a whole lamb if you call in advance. They have a fairly ambitious, I wouldn't say charcuterie program. They buy in their charcuterie from some of the better makers across the country. Also sort of one of their big things is a beef tartare that comes on, I guess, tiny little crumpets, and they're frosted with béarnaise sauce.
That's kind of odd. Does it work?
Yeah, but it's not bad. It's very, let's say, a different version of Eggs Benedict.
Oh, that makes sense.
I think the marquee item there, though not many people will order it, is the whole pig's head.
You didn't see a pig's head on every table when you were there?
I saw some pig's heads, which I guess is more than you see at most places, which is no pig's heads. Or the restaurants that I've been to this summer that seem to have, like, pig's heads as mascots, but no actual pig head on the menu. You can get it a couple of ways. One is as a sort of terrine version of cochinita pibil, the Yucatan dish that doesn't really work that well. And the main one is as a half pig's head. And this is a big pig's head. This isn't a tiny little boutique piglet that's cooked in what they call a general tso's style.
Wow. Is the half kept intact, or is it hacked in pieces?
It's completely intact, and it's on a platter, and it's been slow roasted so the meat is nice and soft and finished at a higher heat in order to crisp it. It's been sort of slicked with sweet, spicy Chinese takeout sauce. It comes with a stack of, they call them mushu pancakes, the floury Chinese pancakes, and you sort of rest away chunks of the cheek or of the forehead or whatever part seizes your fancy at the moment.
So what's the rest of the menu like?
The vegetables are actually pretty good. I mean, there's a big plate of snap peas with fried potatoes. There's beets on this green herb puree made with herbs and avocado, I think. They do the same grilled shishito pepper plate that everybody else in town does. But that's never a bad thing. There's a big clump of ricotta cheese and some of that fermented black garlic that people seem to be using at the moment. It's nice. The other thing that people should probably know about are the sausages, which are different from any sausage in town. There's a beef bulgogi sausage that oddly enough resembles a big plate of beef bulgogi but stuffed into a sausage casing. And something that sounds as if it would be awful but actually wasn't was the chicken parm sausage, which is a chicken sausage that they actually bread and fry.
Wow. And top with tomato sauce and mozzarella?
Yeah, burrata, I think. But yeah, pretty much.
Hey, I would order it.
I know you would. You're a chicken parm person from way back.
So should I ask you about the desserts?
In some circles, all you would have to know is that they put foie gras in the cherry tart.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah, and it's not like they disguise the taste of the liver. It's like it's a livery cherry tart.
So maybe this is one instance where we should recommend that people start with dessert.
They could definitely start with dessert and maybe end with one of the big slices of devil's food cake with molasses buttercream.
All righty then. Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Get more restaurant recommendations from him on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right like green tomatoes.
That is it for this week's show. Go to kcrw.com or download our mobile app to listen to the show. You can also find our podcast and the first installment of a bonus podcast devoted to pie on iTunes. Strangely enough, it is called the Good Food Piecast.
I don't think that peas are bad.
As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That is
Abby Fentress Swanson, Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say,
Pete Bloomberg,
Joel Stein,
Jackie Liu,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
Of course, I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more good food.
All that meat and new potatoes.